Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did the richest people on the planet make their fortunes?
And are they forces for good?
Or agents of chaos?
I'm Xing Xing.
And I'm Simon Jack.
Join us each week for Good Bad Billionaire,
the podcast unravelling tales of fortune, power, ambition and moral responsibility.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you again today. Great, as always, to have your company with us. An economic radical looks like being lined up as Bangladesh's interim leader. So what more do we know about Muhammad Yunus? We'll be taking a look with someone who knows him well in just a moment on the programme. Also today, a major Democratic Party donor in the United States tells us why adding Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to the Harris presidential ticket is the right pick for the party.
He won an election in a state with roughly half Democrats and roughly half Republicans. And he is a very popular governor in that state.
And how a company once synonymous with government rows rode out the market storm one taxi ride at a time.
When you think about in the past, it was burning billions in cash to get people in cars to build that habit. But now you're seeing them really reap those results.
Yeah, plenty more on the eye-popping financial results from Uber in the last few hours. And, of course, we'll be taking you through what else has been going on financial markets now in the wake of days of pretty wild trading on global share markets. A spoiler alert, it's been a lot calmer today. We'll be explaining all of that before we leave you today on World Business Report. Let's start, though, in Bangladesh. One day after the woman who'd led the country for 15 years, Sheikh Hasina, resigned. Today, the Bangladeshi president dissolved parliament, paving the way for the formation of a new interim government. This is the sound from the capital, Dhaka, as army units patrol the streets lined with burned-out cars and ransacked buildings. Student protest leaders had called across those days of protest, weeks even of protest, for Nobel laureate and microfinance pioneer Muhammad Yunus to lead a temporary government. So that's exactly what they've got today, it looks like. So a little bit more about Mr. Yunus himself. What do we know about him? What does he stand for? We've been speaking to Irene Khan, Bangladeshi lawyer and UN special rapporteur, who knows Mr. Yunus well.
I have known Professor Yunus, for about 30, 40 years now. He's a very well-known name. He's a household name in the country because of what he has done. He is, as you know, when he received the Nobel Peace Prize, he was named as the banker to the poor. And that's what he is very well known. He was a pioneer in the area of poverty eradication by providing poor people with small loans.
Yeah, and clearly things like that, innovations like that, that he's going to need
yes.
to do, because the economic situation just runs through the economic backdrop.
Obviously, he has a country in distress right now. So there'll be lots of things to fix. But what he brings to this job is, first of all, a deep understanding of the country. In doing his work, he's traveled a lot. He's met people in villages. People know him. They trust him. As you see, the students turned to him. He's extremely honest. There's a lot that he brings with him, particularly the trust right now.
Well, that's interesting because what he doesn't bring right is what the students have been asking for, which is sort of electoral accountability, right? He's not going to have a mandate. He's not going to have been elected.
Well, he's going to be the advisor to the president in this interim government. So it is not that he is going to run a government for good. And the idea is transition to democracy. That's what has to be done. And the transition has to be done by someone who is not going to be partisan, who's not going to owe any favors to anyone, and who will create an environment in which there can be free, fair elections.
And do you think setting up the rules around that environment are going to be really important to make sure that is the case?
Exactly. And he does not have a political party of his own. As you know, he did not have good relations with the prime minister. She went out and she tried to do everything possible to get some kind of a case to stand against him. And I have gone through his cases because I actually wrote on his behalf to the government, picked up his case, went through it thoroughly, together with other colleagues of mine at the UN, and it was just crazy. There was nothing.
He's got to get the economy on track very, very quickly, hasn't he? Or this could get worse before it gets better.
Yes, and the economy is not off track because of recent troubles. The recent troubles occurred because the economy was going off track. Mm-hmm. You know, and that happened prior to the last rigged elections in October, where you know, the investors could see that there is no rule of law in the country. I mean, the kind of cases they brought up against Yunus, any other businessman in this country could be accused of that. It was just frivolous, totally frivolous, and the courts were clearly being instructed straight from the Prime Minister's office on how to handle it.
Where's your level of hope then?
Well, I have... of course, like everyone, I am worried about the uncertainty, and there is no perfect solution to this, of course, but I believe that he's about the best choice that we can make now. It isn't as though there is a long a pool of people from whom you can select. He has confidence of the international community. He's well known in the international community. He has been able to raise millions of dollars for his Grameen enterprise, and of course previously for Grameen Bank. So there's people know that they can trust him. He knows how to communicate with the international community, and internally as well, he has the trust of the people. The people at large, the one thing they know is that he's an honest man. And it may seem strange to you, but honesty, being an honest man, straightforward, and that he has the best interests of the country at heart, those are extremely important things in this country.
Irene Khan speaking to us from Dhaka in Bangladesh there. Let's move to the United States, where Vice President Kamala Harris, as presumptive Democratic Party nominee and presidential candidate for November's elections, has chosen the Minnesota governor, Tim Walz, to be her running mate in November's elections. The vice president is expected to appear with Governor Walz at a rally in Philadelphia a little later on, their first stop on a four-day tour of battleground states. Mr. Walz, former teacher and military veteran, expected to appeal, or hoped it will be that he appeals to rural working class voters. So what are Democratic donors saying about all of this? Maurice Pearl is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires Group.
The Patriotic Millionaires are a group of hundreds of wealthy business people and investors who believe very strongly that we do not want policies that make the rich richer and everyone else struggling to get by. That does not work for anybody, including the rich people.
That said then, adding Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to the potential presidential ticket, the Democratic running ticket, your take on that today?
Oh, I think it's great. Governor Walz of Minnesota is the governor of a state in the middle of the country that has a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum in his state. And he's been able to pass progressive policies. He's been able to increase taxes on the very highest earners and decrease taxes on the people who have lower incomes in his state. I mean, I'm a progressive person. Most people in our country support progressive policies. That's a fact. It's only when someone comes along and tries to make them afraid of, I don't know, immigrants or demons or boogeymen or someone invading the country that they'll vote against progressive policies that actually are good for the vast majority of people.
Let's turn to the politics. And we know that politics in your country is, well, as it's becoming everywhere, but certainly America leads the way in this one, a financial arms race.
I think after President Biden made his decision a few weeks ago not to pursue his reelection and Vice President Harris became the top of the ticket, that was a huge influx of more donors and more people getting involved and excited about this race. So I think it's going very well, actually, for Vice President Harris and Governor Walz.
You talked about the state that Governor Walz comes from, an interesting state. I mean, Democrats have been doing very well on the edges of big cities where Republicans used to, with lots of college-educated people, and not very well in other bits of the state that have voted Democrat for decades and decades and decades and a much more working-class northern bit. But does that sum up in a nutshell the challenge the governor's actually got here being part of the ticket, too, as well, about how you reach out to those people that, bluntly, the Democratic Party has lost in huge numbers over the last couple of decades?
Well, I think he's an excellent choice because he won an election in a state with roughly half Democrats and roughly half Republicans. And he is a very popular governor in that state. He was able to pass bills through a legislature that was within one seat of evenly divided. So I think he's captured the ability to work with people on both sides of the political spectrum. I think he has an ability to get things done. I think he has an ability to create a consensus, including people who agree with him on everything and people who don't agree with him on everything.
Vibes, for want of a better phrase. Have they changed in the changeover of candidate, do you think, in terms of not activist sentiment, investor sentiment, donor sentiment?
Oh, hugely. A month ago, people were kind of down in the dumps. After that first debate, when, you know, President Biden, even in his own admission, did not do all that well, people, after he decided to give up running for re-election and Kamala Harris is now the candidate, people are hugely more excited. Everyone I talk to has become much more excited now about the election.
That's the Democratic Party donor, Maurice Pearl, then. Now, according to the ride-hailing turned technology giant Uber, flexibility works. Just listen to their ads.
Flexibility is taking the afternoon off, the week off, and then picking right back up where you left off. So it's no wonder 85% of drivers say they need flexibility, because flexibility works.
Yeah, works. Certainly financially, it looks like, from Uber's latest financial results, because Uber has turned its fortunes around somewhat from a company that seems to be under pressure from regulators everywhere to one that, well, is outperforming the rest of the stock market, certainly today or in the last couple of weeks in terms of consumer-facing firms. Natalie Leung, the Bloomberg technology reporter in New York, covers the company. Well, we asked her a bit more about what's going on with them.
Uber delivered some better than expected results today, and their executives pointed to their countercyclical business model, which they said is thanks to some affordable options they have, like think lower cost share rides, shuttle buses that kind of offer that whole suite of, you know, options for people who might be on a budget.
So is it all about the rides, as the company itself would put it, because it's put a lot of effort into other bits of the business? Is it the core bit of the business, the taxi service, if you like, that people will know around the world? Is that the bit that's driving all of this?
Rideshare as a whole is really what's driving the better results today. It's the biggest part of Uber's business. But interestingly, Uber over the years have expanded beyond just the black car services that it's known for in the beginning. It's now expanded to two-wheelers in markets like Brazil and other options as well.
And how's it doing in the bits that it's trying to spin out, for example, here in Europe with you in North America, things like Uber Eats, its kind of food delivery services and things like that? What did we learn?
Delivery is also a bright spot that the company pointed to, even saying it's become a habitual thing that people do on the Uber platform. Interestingly, Uber pointed to its collaboration with Instacart earlier this May, which means they are fulfilling restaurant orders for Instacart customers. And it's been incrementally positive for Uber, as that helps them reach suburban audiences who would place bigger orders.
In terms of innovation, we were talking about this on the program yesterday about the really big tech players, the Metas and the Amazons and the Alphabets, and investors' potential nervousness about the amount that they're spending on the next sort of gambles, I suppose. They're trying to open up selling train tickets to people, mm-hmm. railway tickets for people and things like that. Where do you see the sort of balance? How's the company doing with some of those?
So as you said, the train tickets and flight booking that the company is trying to add around the world is them trying to expand beyond just rideshare, as overall their gross bookings have been slowing down over the past year. So pushing into these new areas would help them gain new ridership, new bookings, as well as keeping that growth momentum.
You watch this company as closely as anybody. Has it surprised you?
Yeah, it's really been through a lot in its 15-year history. When you think about in the past, it was burning billions in cash to get people in cars to build that habit. But now you're seeing them really reap those results and sort of seeing their network really benefiting from the high usage. And what's interesting is even after a lot of cost-cutting efforts and divestiture of some of their more ambitious efforts, like autonomous driverless cars before. Now they're going back into the space with a different approach. That is by partnering with other manufacturers of autonomous vehicles like Waymo. And they actually noted this quarter that those autonomous rides have jumped 6 times versus last year.
Another challenge is now then, are they employee ones? Are they about keeping, you know, I'm sure anybody around the world who's gotten an Uber has heard their Uber driver talk about their terms and conditions and things like that. Is that the kind of, is that the sort of looming challenge for the company, I guess?
So this is something that the company has time and time again defended as part of their core business model of just employing people on the basis of independent contractors to kind of keep their overhead costs lower. And in the past few months, we've seen Uber sort of introduce this new model of independent contractor plus, where the status is still kept independent, but they are offered some benefits of regular employees, like minimum wage or some health benefits. And this we've seen Uber negotiate at a state level in the US.
Our thanks to Natalie Leung, the Bloomberg technology reporter, speaking to us in New York. Well, let's take a look at what else is moving financial markets today. And Deanna Guter, a behavioral financial advisor at Brighton Securities, is with us. Deanna, great to have you back with us on World Business Report. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me again.
Quick thought on Uber. Why do you sense it's bucking the trend when other kind of consumer-facing companies, the McDonald's, the Starbucks, have been really struggling?
Well, I'm thinking people are looking for ways to save money, and sharing rides is a great way. People are going back to work. Now they're going out maybe for a drink or for dinner with a colleague from work. They're going out to dinner more. They're traveling. And then they, instead of going to the airport fighting traffic, they just get an Uber. They don't have to worry about their car. And they don't have to worry about traffic. They can drink responsibly and enjoy a good time.
Has their turnaround surprised you a bit? This was a company that looked like, you know, it was going one way for a while in investment terms, and yet suddenly it's a darling of the stock market again.
Well, so I was reflecting also, as was said, they've overcome a lot of bump in the road, if you will, to becoming profitable. And really right now we're looking at steady demand for ride sharing. And, you know, it costs money for an Uber, but it saves on expenses of a car, the cost of storing a car at the airport. There's a lot of benefits. It's good to see this company doing well.
Take us through the markets today, then. We dedicated a lot of the program this time yesterday to what was going on, a wild old ride. Much calmer today. Why?
Well, we think of it. We still have the backdrop of escalation with the war in the Middle East. But, you know, the U.S. employment is slowing, the economy is slowing down. But we can see this is not the end of the world. Right. We're really keeping our eye on the market data, the labor market. You know, if people have jobs, they'll have money to spend, and keep perspective in the bigger picture. And I think today was a perfect example of that.
Right. Do you see calmness as the kind of outlook then?
Pardon me?
Oh. Do you see, is the outlook a bit of a calmer outlook?
It definitely is a calmer outlook, and it helps us to get perspective. We don't need to catastrophize. Things like this are normal. And year to date, let's look at the S&P is up 10%. The Dow is up. NASDAQ's up 9%. We're looking at year to date. Yes, we'll look at rates and maybe a little bit deeper in September, but I'm not seeing any trigger for an emergency Fed cut.
Deanna, thanks so much for your time. Deanna Guter, the behavioral financial advisor at...
He was known to be a killer. Even if you see him in the town, everybody will say he's the killer.
This is the story of a man who killed so many people, he lost count. But despite his shocking death toll, he only served 12 years in jail.
It's astounding that anybody could get away with it.
And the families of his victims want justice.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Brighton Securities, you're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Now, when it comes to talking about economies, politicians often reach for metaphors, don't they? And sometimes often pretty simplistic ones, ones that kind of link, say, a government's budget with household budgets. Ultimately, though, the language that's chosen to describe those situations might end up defining policies themselves. And that's a problem, according to many researchers. One of those, Joe Mitchell, Professor of Economics at the University of West of England, who's been writing plenty about this and is with us. Joe, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Good evening.
Sketch out, first of all, what we're talking about here.
So I think the problem, as I see it, is that many of the things that are discussed in terms of finances, monetary policy, fiscal policy, those things are not well understood by much of the public, despite them being very important in terms of how much tax people pay, in terms of the quality of government services, and many of those decisions. And when both journalists and politicians explain or describe or discuss those things, as you say, they often use analogies or metaphors, and they do it for a number of reasons. I think journalists often do it sometimes because they don't fully understand these things themselves, or it makes for a snappy headline, or it's something they've picked up from somewhere else. But I think politicians can do it as a way of avoiding explaining the true decision making which is going on. And often this stuff is difficult because chancellors walk a fine line between scoring political points and sort of being sober and grown up and managing the public finances. And so things like, for example, talking about black holes in the public finances, talking about maxing out the nation's credit card.
Well, that's
about
a classic, that one, isn't it? Yeah. Break that one down for us, why it's different. It's not, the government does not have, the government of any country, of any of our listeners all around the world, is not using a credit card in the way you and I are.
Exactly. And there are a number of reasons that's the case. One is the size of the government. In the UK, the government's something like a third of the economy, depending how you measure it, meaning that when the government spends more or spends less, that has such a big impact on the economy that the economy can grow or shrink in reaction. And that means that tax revenues grow or shrink in reaction. So when the government cuts its spending, it can reduce employment, it can reduce economic activity, and therefore reduce its income. And that's, of course, unlike almost any household. If I reduce my monthly shopping bill, that doesn't affect my salary, and likewise for other households. Another reason is that when governments borrow, they do so by issuing bonds into deep liquid markets. There's a huge amount of demand for those financial instruments from institutional investors, pension funds, those kinds of institutions, meaning that there's no real comparison with, for example, me going to a bank asking for a mortgage or something like that. And ultimately, of course, the government owns the Bank of England, which issues the things that it's promising to pay, pounds.
In a sentence or two, Professor, what's the answer here for governments? What should they be doing? What's good practice?
Do you mean in terms of communication?
They should change.
Well, what I would like to see is governments explaining the sort of choices that are in front of them. So the example I was talking about quite a lot recently is Rachel Reeves has told us she's discovered a black hole in the nation's finances. And that carries a very strong sense of sort of catastrophe, something outside of human control, something which requires immediate action. When really what she's, found or is reporting is that there's been overspending in government departments. Much of that overspending is extremely predictable because the spending limits were set when inflation was much lower and inflation's been higher, so costs have overrun. She'd given a public pay rise, and so actually some of the increased costs were a decision she'd made. So really what she, I think, should do is say, we're spending more than we expected or had planned to or had wanted to. Now I have to decide what to do about it. I could borrow a bit more, but that would mean my fiscal rules would need adjusting. I could tax a bit more, but that would mean maybe my pre-election pledges would need a bit of adjusting. But instead, she sort of tells this quite sort of emotive story of a black hole and we have to make difficult choices. And then the journalists, I think, should really challenge this language and say, what is this? Why are you using this language? What are the choices in front of you? And this would be a much more kind of grown up and sensible conversation for all of us, I think.
And so building on that then, what can people, what can we as consumers of this, because we drive it, right? The reason that this happens is because we're the ones who are meant to be unable to understand it any other way. So what can we do, I suppose, as consumers around the world?
Well, I suppose people can try and teach themselves a bit about how fiscal policy and monetary policy and public finances work. But that is difficult because it's hard to find reliable sources and to know who you can trust. You know, you get different versions of the story from different sources. So I think it's really important that, you know, good journalistic outlets and media platforms are really make an effort to explain this stuff clearly to the public.
And so how would you, I don't know, that education, how does that work? How does that best done?
Well, I think it would be really useful in this instance, for example, to say that really what we're talking about is a political choice about income distribution. We want to have public services, which, you know, we don't have crumbling roofs in schools. We don't have long waiting lists in the health service. Somebody has to pay for that. So ultimately, what are the choices in front of the Chancellor? She could raise taxes on, you know, middle income earners, people like myself, university academics, professors and so on. You know, I would reduce my consumption of, you know, some luxuries, perhaps, you know, reduce the quality of my wine, go on holiday a little bit less often.
And don't then, do that.
Exactly. And then society could have a different mix of consumption, of distribution and so on. And that's a very different way of saying this is the choice I'm making. And I can see why politically that's very unpalatable. I mean, she doesn't want to do that. It's explained that really I'm making a choice not to move the burden around.
So we all around the world need to be better at hearing hard messages, right, as well. But there is something about the way we tell some of these things, isn't there, as well? Like our understanding of, you know, for example, I'm sure you've come across this in your research too, Professor, the type of, you know, once it gets to a size of number, people really don't really understand, you know, a trillion or a billion, the size of those numbers, they get so out of whack that it doesn't really mean anything to anybody. That's about communication, isn't it? About language. And that could be done centrally by bodies, whether they be banks or statistics agencies or anybody else.
Yes. And I think something that could be done with these kinds of numbers is to always give a comparison to say, for example, the budget of the National Health Service or the amount spent on schools per year. You know, 100 billion, 50 billion, these kinds of numbers, because then you have a sense, you know, what is 20 billion? It's, you know, it's, I don't know, 20-30% of the NHS budget, something like that, rather than completely context-free, because they just sound huge, as you say, 20 billion, 30 billion, 50 billion, particularly when being benchmarked against fiscal rules, which is another, I think, bit of a deep mystery that many people don't understand.
Yeah, and that's a very UK thing, so don't get us too far off track that in the last 30 seconds or so, because that will really blow people's minds
I mean,
later
on. Most countries have fiscal rules, but yeah, the UK has a very specific kind of discussion around.
Run us through ones then in the last 30 seconds we've got, Professor, or so, for real, you know, trope alert type things. Alarms should be sounding if you hear these at home for our listeners.
Yeah, and anytime you hear somebody saying, well, we have to tighten our belts because that's what households do when the finances are tight, and governments should do the same, or we've been running up the credit card and therefore we make difficult choices in response, or we're fixing the roof while the sun is shining.
Well, there you go. If you hear those, you've been told by Professor Joe Mitchell right here on World Service.
He was known to be a killer. Even if you see him in the town, everybody will say he's the killer.
This is the story of a man who killed so many people, he lost count. But despite his shocking death toll, he only served 12 years in jail.
It's astounding that anybody could get away with it.
And the families of his victims want justice.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, Season 3. The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.